This week on the Best of Flashpoint, Jordan Flaherty and Malik Rahim, activists and journalists in New Orleans, reflect on the fourth year since Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast and the continued inaction and injustice perpetrated by the federal government. Also, Native American leaders prepare to reclaim Mount Rushmore and other sacred sites across the country. Ali Abu Nima talks about the recent Israeli attacks on Gaza and Obama's policies in Palestine. Plus, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern talks about the potential to jail Bush administration officials for torture and kidnapping. And the Night Report returns from exile. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This Friday will mark the fourth anniversary since Hurricane Katrina devastated the Gulf Coast. The hurricane, of course, you'll remember, devastated the city of New Orleans, and many of those people who were wounded then, who were pushed out of their houses, are still struggling to survive, either inside the city or have left town. Joining us to talk about the ongoing situation after 4 years is Jordan Flaherty. He is a reporter who has reported extensively on the situation, all aspects of Katrina and the aftermath. He's got a new piece in Dissident Voice, Homeless and Struggling in New Orleans. Jordan Flaherty, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis. It's an honor to be on.
Well, it's good to have you with us again. You've been doing some very important reporting all through this. Maybe you could just start with a thumbnail sketch of what it looks like to you on the ground after 4 years, somebody who's been on top of this for so long.
In some ways, things have really not changed that much. For some areas, some parts of town, thousands of people are still displaced. Overall, there was almost 500,000 people living in the city of New Orleans pre-Katrina. Now we're at about 300,000. So depending on your estimate, that's around 200,000 folks displaced, not even taking into account the fact that tens of thousands of the new residents are folks that moved here after Katrina. So, you know, I think at a minimum you have 200,000 pre-Katrina residents that are still displaced around the country, especially in Houston, Jackson, Atlanta, other cities. And the reason they're not back is not because they don't want to live in New Orleans. In interviews and studies, overwhelmingly people say they do want to move back, but so many obstacles have been placed in people's way from getting back. The funding has not been there for homeowners to rebuild. For renters, rents have doubled. For people with children, the school system is very hard to navigate. For people with health issues, which in a way can be all of us, the healthcare system is in shambles. The Charity Hospital, which was the free healthcare system for the city, still has not reopened. The school system used to be under the control of the school board, so it had some sort of democratic accountability. Now it's a completely charter system, freed from any sort of democratic accountability to the people most affected. But so overall, it's those hundreds of thousands of people displaced. But, you know, recently, Tracy Washington with the Louisiana Justice Institute talked about the international way that we, you know, define displacement, the international definition. And she said, you know, you're still displaced under international law until those conditions that caused your displacement have been alleviated or you received some sort of reparations for that. And she said, so even for many people in the city are still facing displacement. You know, the way Tracy Washington described it is, I'm still displaced if there's still no healthcare system, if there's still no school system, if the criminal justice system is still unfair, if the rents are doubled, that's still displacement. And I think a lot of, you know, especially poor people in New Orleans are still feeling those results, even when they're back, even in the best case scenario, when they're back in the city, they're still feeling those results of the storm.
Say a little bit more about some of those key issues that you mentioned. For instance, talk a little bit about schools and what kids need and they're not getting, or the schools that they can't find, and medical care. Just hit those two.
Well, you know, education is a complicated system because, you know, it's a problem everywhere in the country. Pre-Katrina, New Orleans had one of the worst school systems in the country. And I think when people looked at the system, there was two different schools of thought of what was wrong with it. Some people felt that what was wrong with it was that it was underfunded, that it was also had the problems of the whole city overall, that there was a weak economy, that there was no job options for people. They were looking at a whole systemic analysis of what was wrong. But I think for some of the power structure of the city of New Orleans, and especially some of the white power structure of the city, a lot of the business owners, they felt that what was wrong with the school system was that it was under the control of the school board, which is majority African American. They felt that the problem was that they couldn't fire teachers because the teachers had union protection. So what happened immediately after the storm is folks saw an opportunity. The school system was seized. The school board, which used to, the New Orleans school board used to be over 124 out of 128 schools. Now they're over 5 schools. The rest of the schools are either charter schools or they're under the control of the state, which is trying to shift them over to charters. So we went from a system with a form of public accountability to no public accountability. The entire staff of all the schools, all the teachers and all the rest of the staff, were all fired immediately. Their union contract was canceled a couple of months later. So this was, that teachers union was the largest union in the city, probably the biggest source of middle-class black political power in the city. That no longer existed. Everyone, if they wanted their job back, they had to reapply for their job. And organizations like Teach for America, and I know there's a lot of great idealistic young folks in Teach for America, have helped in this displacement. This fall, we have 500 Teach for America folks that are there in the city. And these sort of like young volunteers have been a big part of what has displaced the former people that used to be a part of the system and make up this system. So if you're a parent that I think can really do research and can find out what the best schools are and can apply for in advance, if you're a student that has parents that will really advocate for you, you can get a really good education in New Orleans schools. There are some really great schools that are in the system right now. But the problem is the students that are being left behind are the ones that need that help the most, that don't have someone to advocate for them, that don't have someone to fight for them. And the worst schools in the system are now worse than ever before. So we've just seen this increased stratification of good schools for some, excellent schools really for some, and terrible, horrible schools with paint crumbling, buildings crumbling apart, unpainted, no lunches, all sorts of major, major problems that we should not see in any kind of first world country or anywhere in the world that people are facing in the worst of the schools. So we're seeing a disparity. And I think that the people that need the help the most are getting it the least in the new New Orleans.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our series on New Orleans 4 years after it was devastated by Hurricane Katrina and another one and abandoned by the country. And joining us to continue our four-year dialogue is the founder of Common Ground Relief in the Lower Ninth Ward. That's Malik Rahim. Malik has been fighting since the hurricane hit for support, really fighting before that, for support and aid to rebuild devastated communities in the Lower Ninth Ward and other parts of the city. Common Ground has overcome many hurdles to continue the people's work, which has included creating and building schools, medical clinics, houses, you name it. Joining us from the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans with a hammer in his hand is Malik Rahim. Malik, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Oh, thank you, Dennis. And it's an honor.
It's good to have you with us. And why don't we begin with just a little thumbnail sketch of how you see the situation in the Lower Ninth Ward, and for people who don't have the means, the attorneys, the money to get what they need. Give us a sum up of what the deal is.
Well, instead of the Ninth Ward, I would just like to say of the entire Gulf Coast region, from Morgan City, or from Volker Island in Morgan City all the way to the Ninth Ward. You know, it's the same situation, you know, but in each spot there's these higher parts, you know. In the Ninth Ward, I came And, you know, I cannot even say, you know, what it would be if it wasn't for Brad Pitt and his organization, Make It Right. Because, you know, this is the area of the city that have now, you know, was hardest hit, but now have been blessed by someone that is there that is building 21st century homes. Homes that have broken the shackle of dependency upon fossil fuel. You know, MLK, a school, an elementary school, you know, and middle school that is now embarking on our entire curriculum based upon a wetland restoration. So the night water is booming, but it is because of the efforts of individuals. And it's sad to say it isn't government driven.
Well, Barack Obama says that he has recommitted himself to pick up the ball that was dropped by the Bush administration. Can you begin to see his fingerprints on the rebuilding?
Well, you know, before you could even look at the rebuilding, you know, because a community or a city is more than just mortar and bricks. We have to look at the social dynamic. You know, we have to address how can one segment of this country deny access to its citizens simply because of race. We have to address those vigilantes. Now we have tape have been revealed in which one of the vigilantes is telling the police that he killed 38, that they killed 38 people, 38 human beings, and that they gave the bodies to the Coast Guard. And this police didn't feel that tape, or no one felt that tape was worth investigating. That's why I'm thankful for Flashpoint, Democracy Now!, The Nation magazine, and most and above all, the Bayview newspaper, who, when I stated about these killings, had the audacity to allow me to express those days of fascism that exist in the aftermath of Katrina. And that's something that I don't think that he have done. You know, they say that now there's a federal probe on these killings, and that individuals is going before the federal grand jury. But, you know, you hear nothing. You hear nothing on the media. 38 people.
Now let's remind people, and you're talking about the San Francisco Bayview newspaper, that has been on top of reporting about the vicious treatment, the racism, the abject racism that accompanied this devastating hurricane. Now, when you're talking about 38 bodies and vigilantes, say a little bit more. When you say this is not, you are not talking hyperbole. When you say vigilantes, you mean vigilantes. What's their relationship to the body? Explain this.
Well, I'm going to tell you, that's all your viewers have to go is to WDSU.com and then go to Algiers Vigilantes. And they can pull this up themselves. And there's no outrage that this can happen in America. There's no outrage. You know, because again, a city is more than mortar and bricks. Right now, New Orleans is classified as the fastest growing city in America. You know, but unemployment among African Americans in this city that's traditionally been trained in the construction field, in the midst of a city in a construction boom, is over 25%. Right now, we have $1 billion worth of construction projects going on as I'm speaking to you in Algiers alone. $1 billion worth of construction projects going on. And only a handful of people out of this community is employed in it. And the jobs that they are employed as, labor. So when you look at, yes, you could say New Orleans is being rebuilt. And you got to give the, you know, the credit where credit is due. And that is what Brad Pitt is doing unselfishly. You know, with the volunteers that we have had to come down, now over 22,000 volunteers.
And they're still wanted and needed.
Oh, yes. Because, see, one of the things that we can do, we can show that, hey, we can save New Orleans. And we have to save it. New Orleans is too critical, not just to to this region or to this state. You know, it's too critical to this nation. And so we have to do it. And we could do it in such a way that we could show the rest of the world. What can we do? When people understand the essence of what makes a nation great. And that those who stand up and show that they are willing to make a sacrifice in expressing their civic responsibilities or understanding the importance of civic responsibility. You know, we need to do this. You know, I mean, the only community in this city in the aftermath, and you're talking about well over 3,000 homes just in the Ninth Ward alone. The only homes that is being rebuilt and rebuilt green, the only homes that is being rebuilt and you see solar on top of each and every roof that is being utilized now is those homes that came from Brad Pitt. You know, it's no... No, I'm going to tell you, with all that we have done, we have served over 500,000 people. You know, we never even received a proclamation from the city. You know, the only person to lose their life volunteering in this city, Meg Perry. The city don't even recognize her.
How did she lose her life, Malik?
She was leaving New Orleans on a vegetable bus that she had drove down to this city from Portland, Maine. And she was leaving here after working and establishing community gardens and doing bioremediation work in the city of New Orleans. She was leaving here going to Houma to work in Punishy, you know, with the Houma Nation. And on her way, they had a bus accident, and she was crushed. And I was right in the city of New Orleans, but the media in the city, they only declared her to be a drifter.
And drift, so,
oh, yes. I mean, so if you look at New Orleans, you know, it is now moving toward the same path as San Francisco.
If you can get that cash for the million-dollar house, you're in.
Yeah.
But if you've got three kids and one parent in the household, and you need some medical care and a place to go to school, you're going to be in trouble. Let me tell people, we're speaking with Malik Rahim. He is the founder of Common Ground Relief. They are based in the lower ninth ward of the city of New Orleans, the most devastated part, one of the most devastated parts after Katrina hit, and not a lot of help from the federal government.
Dawn some mornings, not wanting to rise out of bed from under the down feather horizon. If the sky grows tired of being everywhere at once, adapting to the mood swings of the weather. If clouds drift off trying to hold themselves together, make deals with gravity to loiter a little longer. I wonder if rain is scared of falling, if it has trouble letting go, if snowflakes get sick of being perfect all the time, each one trying to be one of a kind. I wonder if stars wish upon themselves before they die, if they need to teach their young how to shine. I wonder if shadows long to just for once feel the sun, if they get lost in the shuffle, not knowing where they're from. I wonder if sunrise and sunset respect each other, even though they've never met. If storms have regrets, if volcanoes get stressed, if compost believes in life after death. I wonder if breath ever thinks of suicide, if the wind just wants to sit still sometimes and watch the world pass it by. If smoke was born, knowing how to rise, if rainbows get shy backstage, not sure if their colors match right. I wonder if lightning needs an alarm clock to know when to crack, if rivers ever stop and think of...
Joining us to talk about the current situation in occupied Palestine and in the region is Ali Abunima. Ali is the editor and co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and the author of One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Ali, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Nora.
So let's begin with the news from Palestine today. Can you talk about Israel's resumed bombing of the southern Gaza Strip in attacks that killed at least three Palestinian brothers early this morning, as the entire strip itself remains sealed and occupied and besieged in its third year of the blockade?
Yes, I mean, it's a reminder that just because it's not being reported in the mainstream media that the violence against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip is ongoing, and this violence is part of the existing regime of maintaining the blockade on 1.5 million people. Yesterday there was an incident in which these brothers were approaching the border fence with Israel to look for scrap metal to sell because of the economic destitution created by the blockade, and they were shot. And then overnight the bombing of the tunnel near the across the border, the tunnel that goes under the border between Gaza and Egypt. Of course, these tunnels now are one of the few ways that Palestinians in Gaza have to communicate with the outside world because of the tight Israeli and Egyptian blockade that is supported by the United States, the European Union, and other Arab states. The blockade is so tight. To give you an idea, just last week, among the things brought in through the tunnels, well, it was a person, it was a bride, a bride who was traveling from the West Bank to marry her fiancé in the Gaza Strip. She first had to travel from the West Bank to Jordan, then from Jordan to Egypt, and then finally through a tunnel into Gaza. That just gives you a sense of the brutality of this siege and how much violence and how much repression is involved in maintaining it.
And meanwhile, both the U.S. and the U.K. administrations are holding talks with the Netanyahu government, parroting each other, softly urging Israel to halt settlement construction in the West Bank and Jerusalem, but saying nothing about Gaza. And these settlement colonies are expanding and growing around the clock. There's nothing that's been halted about them. And we have the Israeli housing minister saying that apartheid is essential. It's a national duty. The U.S. State Department is saying that it's approaching an agreement on renewing negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. Ali, what's behind the rhetoric and handshakes between Netanyahu and the U.S. and the U.K.? Will these negotiations have any effect whatsoever on the ground in Palestine, especially since Gaza is still under attack?
Well, the cordial tone between Netanyahu and Prime Minister Gordon Brown and the United States reflects the fact that there's actually a consensus. Back in June, Netanyahu proposed a demilitarized, truncated Palestinian state with most of the settlers staying where they are. And that, in fact, is what the Obama administration is most likely to support in Palestine. A few months ago, a bipartisan Democratic Republican sort of report written by establishment ex-officials, people like Brent Scowcroft and Zbigniew Brzezinski, actually it was published last November around the time of the election, advising Obama, says, look, you know, the U.S. should actively push for a demilitarized Palestinian state on part of the West Bank, with most of the settlers staying where they are. So there isn't much difference between Netanyahu and the United States and its allies on the final destination. They're just not coming out and saying it openly. Although if they come to an agreement on the so-called settlement freeze, the next step may be the U.S. saying, look, this is what we think a final agreement should look like. And then we'll see how actually close it is to what Netanyahu is proposing. The reason for the silence about Gaza is that there is a consensus there. The United States fully supports the blockade, as does Israel and the European Union. They're all working to enforce the blockade. And this is all about the strategy, the long ongoing strategy of trying to destroy Hamas, trying to deny it the mandate that was given to it at the election in 2006, and to prop up a puppet leadership in the West Bank, armed and trained by the United States to keep control and effectively to manage the occupation and later the putative Palestinian state on Israel's behalf. That's the way things have been heading consistently, and I don't see that direction changing.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we continue our coverage of the torture regime led by George Bush, a wide-ranging regime of torture, kidnapping, abduction, some people say rendition. We're going to talk to a former high-level CIA analyst who's a little bit frustrated. His name is Ray McGovern. He has a piece in Consortium News up on the web now. Let me just read you a little bit of the opening. Do you think the wardens will let George Tenet wear his Presidential Medal of Freedom over the orange coverall? Perhaps he and Donald Rumsfeld will end up doing time together in one of the prisons also slated to host what Rumsfeld called, quote, the worst of the worst from Guantanamo. That would be poetic justice, McGovern writes, of a most ironic kind. And if the two former leaders do end up in prison, they can count themselves fortunate for having dodged execution for their roles in a slew of capital offenses. Ray McGovern joins us from the Washington, D.C. area, where he has lived for some time and worked. Welcome back, Ray.
Thank you, Dennis.
All right, let's start with a thumbnail sketch. And I guess you are not kidding, and this is not hyperbole, when you say, based on your reading of this Inspector General's report, these guys could face execution.
Well, yes. The War Crimes Act of 1996, which was passed by the way, by a predominantly Republican Congress, had provision for extreme penalties, including execution, for those who violated the Act, and the Act, of course, was tied to the Geneva Convention. Either one, if they violated, and someone died in their custody. That was the key thing. If there were murders or someone died as a result of torture, then the death penalty could be applied. Now, what people probably don't know is that President George W. Bush was warned about this. He was warned about this by Cheney's lawyer, Addington, and Alberto Gonzalez, who at that time was the White House counsel, in a memo that was saying, look, you know, exempting whole categories of folks like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from the Geneva protections for prisoner of war, well, technically, Mr. President, you know, we need to advise you as your lawyers that there is this War Crimes Act in 1996, and it does provide very extreme penalties, including death, for violations of this act. But, and here's the wonderful sentence, we believe that there, quote, is a reasonable basis in law, end quote, that in the event that some mean-spirited prosecutor or special counsel should proceed against you in the future on these charges, that your determination that Geneva doesn't apply will probably suffice to avoid conviction. Now, that's in a January 25 memorandum signed by Gonzalez but drafted by Addington, and it was the basis upon which George W. Bush issued his smoking gun torture memo, the one I've mentioned before, the one that's dated February 7, 2002, which said, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, they don't get Geneva protections. We will treat detainees, quote, humanely, comma, as appropriate, comma, and as consistent with military necessity, end quote. And Dennis, people don't have to believe McGovern anymore on this. The Senate Armed Services Committee, without dissent, ruled back in December at the end of a study that it was that memo, February 7, 2002, two-pager, signed by George Bush in these big felt-tip pen strokes, it was that memo that, quote, opened the door, end quote, to subsequent abuses. So it's right out there, and my hope is that once Holder gets going on this, or I should say Durham, the prosecutor here, it will be not possible to focus on the proverbial, quote, apples at the bottom of the barrel, end quote, because just as in Abu Ghraib, just as there, in this case with the CIA folks, it goes to the very top, and the apples at the very top of the barrel, Cheney and Bush, are the ones who's oozing foul the whole barrel, and there's a whole lot of apples in that barrel. So I'm more hopeful now, Dennis, than I have been in weeks, that this thing will reach, will not be able to be circumscribed into addressing just abuses of people who waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 183 times instead of the 181 times that were allowed by the Justice Department memos. As soon as all that crazy stuff hits the light of day, and I might mention that even the Washington Post this morning had a very, very revealing front page article. So if the Post is coming around and informing the American people, I just would be very surprised, still very surprised, if the American people just sit back and say, oh, well, you know, let's just look forward. It doesn't matter that we become a country of torturers. Let's just hope it never happens again. These people need to be held accountable.
Well, let's talk a little bit about even what's in the heavily redacted and cleansed report released by the Central Intelligence Agency. And you read it. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, with some precise detail, exactly what they did to people.
Well, we know as a result of the revelations here that he threatened people with death. They brought revolvers or pistols into the interrogation sessions, that they held mock executions, you know, the fellow in the next cell, boom, you know, as if that's going to fool a real terrorist. And then they threatened people's families. So you want to ever see your children again? Well, you know, something bad's going to happen to your children. They threatened a couple of people in saying that they would get their mothers there and sexually abuse them in front of these prisoners. All these things are beyond the pale. All these things are things that are not allowed under any lawful regime. And so the question is, you know, what will the special prosecutor do now? And it's going to be really interesting, Dennis, because, you know, if you take the White House lawyers, you know, those mafia lawyers who kind of sat around the table and said, now, how can we make torture legal? Well, this is the way we do it. We say it's not torture unless it results in one of two things, death or major organ failure. Up to that, you can pretty much do anything you want, okay? Now, under that logic, is holding a gun or, in one case at least, an electric drill, right, you know, an inch away from a person's temple and turning it on, is that that cause major organ failure? No. Did it cause that? No, obviously so. I can see these guys, you know, these real creeps arguing. Well, you know, we assumed that this was okay if they let us keep people awake for 11 days, if they let us waterboard people. Well, what's wrong with this? So it's going to be very messy, and the lawyers who, quote, authorized, end quote, all this stuff, and the White House people who ordered up these opinions, and that's a key point. You know, people keep talking about, well, the people who did this in good faith, there wasn't any good faith, and that's going to come out very clearly when the memos from the White House to people like John Yoo are released. And of course, they say, now we want to be able to do this, find us a juridical, a lawyerly justification for it. That's going to come out, and so it will be revealed that there was no good faith here, and whether that redounds down the line to the folks who waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 183 times instead of only 181 or whatever it was, you know, can they be said to have been working in good faith? Well, yeah, you know, my general answer to that, Dennis, is, you know, we're all adults, right? We know there are laws against such things. We know that it's not quite right to treat other human beings that way. And we know that there are laws against these things because it's wrong, okay? It's not wrong because there are laws against it. And I think people basically realize, I made the mistake out your way, actually, in the Bay Area, of writing something that said, you know, from a Christian tradition, we well know that this is just beyond the pale. That's dead wrong. And an atheist with whom I was staying sort of say, look, Ray, hey, man, don't limit this to Christians, for God's sake. I'm an atheist, and I know it's wrong. So include us in, would you? And I just cite that. Because it's so revealing that, you know, people know these kinds of things are wrong. And the last thing I'll say on this is this. I know a little bit about Germany. I lived there 5 years. I was born 70 years ago yesterday, a week before Hitler drove his tanks into Poland.
Happy birthday.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. But, you know, what I know about the Germans is that, you know, they really, by the time Hitler got going, you know, if you disobeyed an order to torture somebody, well, you got shot, okay? No one I know, Dennis, has been arguing that these CIA guys, you know, if they said, well, you know, I really, you know, it does something to my stomach when I do this, so I think, please, I'm going to, give me a job in the library. The truth seems to be that nobody thought to say that because they realized that nobody's going to shoot them, and so the burden on them, it seems to be, is even more heavy to prove that they went ahead and did it anyway. In other words, long-winded way of saying, the Nazi people, the people who worked for the SS or the Gestapo, they said, no, I'm not going to shoot that lady. And, well, they get shot in the head. A CIA guy who says, no, I don't want to waterboard somebody. Well, they get transferred to the library. Maybe it hurts their career. My God, can you imagine? It hurts their career. But then I got to be shot. And so, you know, what I'm saying is that if they didn't leave off, if the Nazis who argued, oh, he was only following orders, right? If they didn't get off, and I don't see why anybody should get off, because we're all adults, and we know that we don't abuse other human beings this way.
Coming up next, we're going to be talking about reclaiming sacred sites at Mount Rushmore. Listen to this.
American Indians are using a well-known national landmark to carry their land claim protest to new heights. Ike Pappas reports from the Black Hills of South Dakota.
Another dawn rises over Mount Rushmore, over Washington and Roosevelt, Jefferson and Lincoln. But it also rises these days over a small band of American Indians who cling not only to the craggy edges of the mountain, but to the hope that someday this land will be theirs again.
Three times each day, teams of young men and women make the 3,000-foot climb to the Indian camp to bring supplies to support their protest. These Indians have renamed Mount Rushmore. It is now called Crazy Horse Mountain.
The Indians, about 30 of them, have been here since last weekend when, against federal regulations, they set up a camp on the mountainside close to the memorial. They claim these Black Hills of South Dakota are legally theirs by treaty, and they have come to take them back. To dramatize their protest, the Indians perch on a ledge overlooking the main pavilions and shout slogans to the tourists below. Their leaders is Layman Brightman, president of United Native Americans, an Indian protest group.
Well, first I should say the federal government said this land would belong to us as long as the grass grows and the water flows and the sun shines. Then 6 years later they sent General Custer into this area on an expedition and they discovered gold here in the Black Hills. Then they turned around and took this land from us. We're sick and tired of sitting back and turning the other cheek and then bend over and get those other two kicked. You're going to see some wide awake, educated Indians. We got some new Indians coming up, new warriors. And this is a breeding ground right here. You're going to see a lot of spark.
The National Park Service at first offered some small resistance to...
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I am Dennis Bernstein. And on Saturday, United Native Americans and other indigenous Native American groups will gather again at Mount Rushmore in an attempt to reclaim indigenous sacred sites in North America. You might know Mount Rushmore. It's known for those gigantic etchings in the rock of key American presidents. The monument is considered a huge and gaping wound in Indian lands. Native activists first gathered, as we said, to retake Mount Rushmore in 1970. That's 39 years ago. They're going back this Saturday. And joining us to talk about that action is somebody who was there then, and you heard his voice, Dr. Lee Brightman. He's a retired UC Berkeley professor and the founder of the first Native American Studies program at UC Berkeley, and he is here as a part of this with his son, also a member of United Native Americans. And you heard Quanah Parker Brightman on these airwaves very recently talking about Leonard Peltier and other Native issues. We thank both of you for coming in and being with us on Flashpoints. And let me start with you, Dr. Brightman. You were there 39 years ago. You're ready to go back again. What's at the core? What's at the heart of the matter for you?
Well, they took the Black Hills from us. They signed a Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. And in the Fort Laramie Treaty, they took two-thirds of Indian land in South Dakota and let us keep about one-third. And the Black Hills were part of the one-third we kept. And they came in a few years later, and some white miner found gold. and your Indians came in, the non-Indians started pouring in, your Sioux tried to repulse them. So then they brought in the 7th Cavalry, and the 7th Cavalry were used to put the Indians down while the invading whites stole the gold. And they turned around then, and they're putting the Indians down. So they wanted the Indians to move onto a certain area of South Dakota, get out of the Black Hills and move into a more desolate area out there. And they didn't want to go. And so they sent George Custer, well, they sent 3 regiments of cavalry in to get them and move them into this area. And they didn't want to go. And they sent out these 3 regiments. Well, whoever found, they had the word went out that whoever found them was to notify the other 2 regiments, and they would surround them and kill any Indian over 12 years of age. And Custer and his 7th Cavalry found them first. Instead of notifying the other 2, he did the Sioux a favor. He didn't get a hold of the other 2. Custer wanted to be president. And then he divided his group, 7th Cavalry, into 3 groups. And when he did, he made a huge mistake there. And Benteen and Reno were the other charge of 2 groups, and Custer was in reserve. And they attacked the Sioux. But his Crow scouts warned him. They said, you're outnumbered about 10 to 1. You'll get killed if you go in there. And he wouldn't, he was an egomaniac, and he wanted to go in anyway. And as the Crows started singing their death song, because they knew they were going to die. Well, he went in and he sent Reno and Benteen in, and he came in, and they wiped them out. And they killed them down near to the man. My great-grandfather, there were only 20 Indians killed in that battle. And the Mormons put out a book called Custer's Fall. And my grandfather is one of the Indians listed in there and that got killed. And so I went to the battlefield. I took my 3 sons up there one time. We were looking around and checking, you know, where they had the Indians. They had 1 Indian there in my great-grandfather, they had his burial there. But they had you go around and look at the battlefield, and could have been avoided. But Custer, you know, during the Civil War, he was made a boy general, and he had the highest kill rate of his own men. More of them got killed, him leading them into ambushes, into goddamn, you know, impossible situations. And he's lucky he hadn't got out. But he and Tom Custer, his brother, didn't make it out of Custer's last stand a little later.
Now, of course, it would be a particular insult to etch the white presidents into the rock of the Black Hills. This would be, as they say, adding insult to deep injury, right?
You know, I was teaching at UC Berkeley. I started the Indian Studies program there. It was the first in the country. They had a Black, Chicano, and Asian studies, and so I went to them, and I asked the Black, Chicano, and Asian, if you'll support me, I'm going to ask them to start an Indian Studies. And they agreed to, so I went over and asked them, and they kind of hem-hawed, and I said, if you don't, I'm going to sue you. And so I said, you don't stand a chance. You have enough common sense to realize that. So they agreed to start an Indian Studies. And so they were looking around for an Indian PhD to start it. There were only 10 in America in 1969. 10 Indians out of a whole race of people that had PhDs. I think there was about 5 medical doctors and about 6, 7, 8 lawyers. And not that many Indians, you know, got an education or had that opportunity. And so they're hunting for an Indian PhD, and they got a hold of one named Jack Forbes up at Davis. He's the most brilliant man I've ever met.
And he's still up there now? He's still up there now? Yeah.
He's a very brilliant man. I owe a lot to him. They offered it to him, and he said, no, he didn't want it. He said, why don't you give it to Brightman? He just finished his master's, and he's working on his doctor's degree there. So they offered it to me, and hell, I didn't know anything about Indians. I was a history major. I never took a course where they ever mentioned anything positive about Indians other than we raided wagon trains and killed white women and children. So they offered it to me, and I thought, well, hell, I don't...
Is that on the air?
Okay.
Okay. All right, go on. I'm sorry.
So I turned around, and I thought about it, and I said, I'll give you my answer in a couple of days. So I thought about it, and I thought, if I don't take it, they're going to give it to somebody else. So I said, I'll take it. And so they started the Black, Chicano, and Asian. And I'm sure they had the same problems because, you know, they had to develop courses. And so I developed a political science course dealing with the treaty signed with Indians, how many call for health and how many call for education and so forth, and put together a course in about 2 or 3 weeks that and I worked on it all along. And the students thought it was good. But I put it together, and the second semester got better and better and better. But that was the first Indian Studies program. Yeah.
And this... pilgrimage to Mount Rushmore, to where these presidents are etched in, that's very specific, and at the heart of the taking of Indian lands. That's where you're going there, right?
Yes. That all started... They asked me to the National Indian Education Association. It's the largest education group in the country, other than the National Congress of American Indians. They're the two big Indian groups. And they asked me to come to Minnesota to give a talk at their national meeting. So I went up there to give a talk, and I gave the talk. And afterwards, they sent us from South Dakota. They got together and sent an Indian organization, Rapid City, sent this kid named Marty Walker over and to come over and get me in Minnesota and ask me to come over and help them demonstrate at Mount Rushmore. And so he found me there, and I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I want you to come over and help us. And I said, well, what are you doing? And he said, we're demonstrating at Mount Rushmore. And I said, why? And he said, well, they don't have any Indians employed there. They stole the land from us, never paid us for it, and they don't have any Indians working there. So I said, okay, I'll help. So I went out, and I got a hold of Dennis Banks and Clyde Belcourt and some other people and some other organizations, and I collected a few bucks, and I threw in the rest myself and chartered a bus and filled it up with people who wanted to go over and demonstrate, mainly students. And we drove all day and night, got there the next day, and went out there, and they were picketing down in front of Mount Rushmore. They had a little demonstration. And they didn't know how to picket. There were no noise, and they had small picket signs, and there were about 10 of them, I guess, and you couldn't hear them at any place. So I said, what are you doing? And they said, we're picketing. And I said, I don't hear any noise. Where are your signs? And they had little dinky signs, you know. So I turned around, and I sent this guy into town, and I said, go in there and get us some placards, some huge placards, and get some paint. And we started passing out these big white signs, you know, and we made all these picket signs. And we were, you know, demonstrating there. And then we went over, and they had an area there, and we set up a mic so different people would talk. So while they were talking, I went into the bookstore, and they were selling pictures of the Indians they'd killed at Wounded Knee Creek in 1890. And I looked, and I said, you're selling, and the pictures of, they'd killed 250 Sioux after they disarmed them. They killed men, women, and children after they disarmed them. And they loaded them in wagons, and they were soldiers. So they showed soldiers standing on the bodies, and they'd throw them off the wagons, and they took an area that's about 50 yards long, about 10 feet deep and about 10 foot wide, and they had these soldiers take all these Sioux that they'd killed, and they were dumping them into this trench and pouring lime over them and laughing as they stood on the bodies. And they'd killed them for is they violated the religious code. See, in 1890, the federal government passed a law that it's against the law for an Indian to worship his religion. And is it 1890 and 1904, they enriched the laws. And they killed all these Indians because they had violated the religious code. See, they don't tell you that. There's freedom of religion in this country unless you're an Indian. You're a black, Mexican, Asian, or whatever you want. You can worship your religion, but they outlawed Indian religion in 1884, enriched it in 1904, where that lasted till 1904. And in 1890, they slaughtered 250 Sioux. Out of that, most of them were women and children. And as they were doing it, they were hollering, "Remember Custer's last stand."
Wow.
In today's Night Report, the latest from Afghanistan and your reporter's farewell to exile. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The resistance spoke loudly to post-electoral Afghanistan today with five simultaneous car bombs in the southern city of Kandahar. The attacks killed 4 dozen persons and wounded nearly 100 in a secure neighborhood near the offices of the National Intelligence Agency, the United Nations, and a Japanese contractor slated to build roads through Taliban-controlled territory. Official responsibility has yet to be claimed for the largest blast in Kandahar since the U.S. invasion and occupation of 2001. In Kabul, the first official partial results of the nation's fraud-tainted presidential election were announced today, with the first 10% of the counted votes giving incumbent President Hamid Karzai a 41-39% lead over the former Northern Alliance coordinator Abdullah Abdullah. The sample is too small to determine whether final results will fulfill the Karzai administration's claims that he won by 70% in a low turnout tainted by Taliban intimidation and regional fraud. If Karzai fails to be certified with more than 50%, there will be an equally contentious runoff election in October. Meanwhile, Pentagon commanders are asking for even more U.S. occupation troops than the 17,000 rushed in to patrol the elections. They were part of President Obama's recent escalation of 22,000 troops, bringing the current U.S. presence in Afghanistan to 70,000. In the interim, the military has recently shifted dozens of additional spy planes and missile drones to Afghanistan, but field commanders say that the Taliban remains the strongest it's been in the past 8 years of occupation. And finally, on a personal and institutional note, a farewell to exile. Over the years, a great many listeners to Flashpoints have asked your reporter the meaning of his sign-off. From exile in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints. Discretion is the better part of valor, but suffice it to say that your reporter's decades at Pacifica's New York unit, WBAI, were interrupted for the past 4 years under the tenure of an administration that suffered record losses in audience and listener support, jeopardizing the financial stability of both station and network. Earlier this summer, that management was replaced. Through the fiduciary wisdom of the Pacifica National and WBAI local boards, and under the guidance of Interim Executive Director Grace Aaron, Chief Financial Officer LaVarne Williams, and Interim WBAI Program Director Tony Bates, among a great many others. And from exile, no longer, in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.